Welcome to my podcast, Today's Dream, Tomorrow's Reality. My name is Vicki Poole. I'm a master transformational coach and hypnotist specializing in habit change. And this podcast is sponsored by the Enlightened Peach, and it's all about embracing our mosaic life. And some of you may ask, what is a mosaic life anyway? Well, it is recognizing that all the pieces of our life, the good, the bad, the indifferent, have all come together to make us who we are. Change any one thing and we are different. With that in mind, I invite you to embrace your perceived imperfections and celebrate who you are. This podcast is unedited and raw, just like life. I am your host, and today I have a special guest that I'll introduce in just a moment. But before I do, I want to ask you to do me a solid, and that is to leave a comment on this episode and like, subscribe, and share, because my whole purpose of doing this podcast is to share people's amazing stories and get them out so other people can hear. And I can only do that with your help. So go ahead, leave a comment, and remember, like, subscribe, and share. So now let's get started. All right. This lovely lady is Katarina. And I will be honest, we don't know each other really well. We've had an amazing conversation previously to just talk about things. And I am so excited to have her on here. And I'm going to let her introduce herself to you. And then we're going to just have a chat and get to know each other a little bit more. And you'll be here for the fun. So Katarina, go ahead and just introduce yourself.
Hi. So I'm so glad to be here with you. I'm so glad you invited me onto your podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation, our first conversation that we had. I think we really connected well, and we had a lot of like alignment in our thought processes. And that's really great. I love what you're doing. I'm hoping to find other people to introduce you to that where you can help them, you know, grow in their businesses and in their lives. My name is Katarina Gossett. I am 65 years old, and I have owned businesses since I was really young, and I've never really worked for anybody else. I tried a couple of times. It wasn't my cup of tea. And so I have always been basically on my own journey. And I just love helping people. And I also like to bring enlightenment to the problems that a lot of us go through and trauma and everything that we don't typically want to share or have not been allowed to share or have been allowing also those traumas to hold us back from being all that we can be and to be able to be especially successful in business. So that's who I am.
Oh, well, perfect. That's an amazing introduction there. You did so much better than I would have. Well, I just wanted to ask, you know, we all get into our path for a reason. There's something that's happened that has put us into the place where this feels important. And so, you know, what was going on when you were a kid that you knew you wanted to be an entrepreneur? I asked this because I was raised by entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. and yet I still got jobs working for other people and doing all of those things because that's really what you're supposed mm-hmm. to do when you're growing up, right?
Right.
The elusive they. And so I worked for others many, many times. And then I became a hairstylist and I worked at salons where I was just a commissioned employee. And then I started working as my own employer. And it's like there's a level of uncertainty that goes with it all the time. Or that's been my experience. You know, it's one of the things that I heard a lot growing up. And I guess it's one of my mental blocks. It's feast or famine, mm-hmm. you know, and there are people that stick to doing a corporate job or working for somebody else just because it's the known. And they know every week what they're going to make, how many hours they're going to get in, how they can plan their evening and their weekends and all of that stuff, but you don't really have that as an entrepreneur. So how did you get to that place and then transition through all of that?
So my dad was, my mom and dad got divorced when I was really young. So they had four children. I was the oldest, and they got divorced when I was seven. So quite, you know, quite young. My dad was in the military. He was a Navy. He ended up becoming a Navy captain, and he had an amazing career, but he wasn't in our life a lot because of my mom's issues. My mom had a extremely brilliant, she had a full lifetime scholarship to Stanford University. They even have a memorial stone for her at Stanford. Brilliant human being, but she was bipolar. We didn't know what that was back in those days. She was an alcoholic. She took drugs. She was addicted to sex. So she was very, what we would consider immoral, you know, and it was a very, didn't take care of her children. She would rather be at school teaching. She would rather be taking more classes or hanging out with guys. And so we were, us four were pretty much left to fend for ourselves. So I was a straight A student, my whole childhood. I would force my siblings to sit down and learn from me. So they all knew how to read and do everything by the time they even went to kindergarten, because I loved learning and I loved reading books. And my mom had a lot of books. She would take us to Stanford with her. So we got to go to the libraries and we got to, you know, see a lot of this and be around intellectuals and things like that. She was also very eccentric. She was an extremely good singer. She played the harpsichord. She's Latvian. So she sang in all these really big Latvian song festivals all over this side of the Iron Curtain. This is all while the Iron Curtain was still up. And she was very famous underground in Latvia, where she wrote anti-communism poetry and things like that. So she had all these really good qualities, but she was never meant to be a mother. And so she had four children who she loved us, but she just didn't know how to take care of us. So we would actually be starving to death. My little brother had malnutrition so bad that he had one of those bellies just like the kids in Africa you see on TV. And my mother thought it was hilarious. She thought it was funny. She would say, "Oh, poke out your belly," you know, and then she would laugh and poke it. And I'm just like, she never realized that he was hungry, you know? And so from a very early age, I had to take care of those siblings. One time when we were living in Germany, my aunt had come, my father's sister came to live with us. And she told me this story. She said, I was around five. And she said, and so my mother already had my brother and my sister. I think she was pregnant with my baby brother. And my mother would stay up. So she was bipolar, right? So she'd go on those really big highs. Mm-hmm. So she was a painter and an artist. So she'd go up into the attic where she had all her art stuff. And she would stay up there for sometimes 24 hours without ever coming down. And then she would sleep for 24 hours kind of thing, you know? So she was sleeping at this time when my aunt had flown in from the States. And she goes into the kitchen and she goes, and there you were, a five-year-old girl making sandwiches for your siblings and making food for your trying to make baby food for your baby sister. And she was just so appalled that I had to do that. So she went up to my mother and she said, "Hey, you know, your kids are hungry. You need to go down and feed them." And my mother just said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah, all your babies, they're hungry." She goes, "Oh, I love my babies. I love my babies. Bring me my babies." And like, still wouldn't go and make the food. So it was like this, you know, of course, now we know, you know, this is back in the 60s. Nobody knew what that whole, you know, how that was transpiring into her life. And the traumas that she had gone through, of course, now they're trying to, we broke those cycles, but they could have been just like ongoing, right? Like none of us in our family are alcoholics and none of us take drugs. And so we had made those decisions, you know, early on, but she and her family escaped from Stalin. They were very, very wealthy people in Latvia. And one of the first things Stalin wanted to do was kill everybody that owned a business, kill anybody who owned land, because, and then take it all for the state. And so when he went through Latvia, they actually had a list of people to exterminate. And our family was one of those.
Oh, wow.
So my great grandfather, he was one of the big chemists and the very famous all over the world. He invented fertilizer and, but you don't hear about these people, you know, anymore. So they took what they had and they got on a boat and they went to Germany, and they were getting to Germany right as the war was pretty much ending, it was a safe, unfortunately, Hitler was the safe place for Latvians to go. So a lot of Latvians went to Germany. And by that time, the Americans had already come in and they were making all of a lot of the concentration camps into refugee camps. So my family was all in that refugee camp, and they were there for 5 years. And my mother was she was like 11 or 12. So now we know what happened to her, because now we know what happens in refugee camps. But in those days, any kind of rape or anything that would happen, you would never say anything to anyone. This is like 40s, 50s, right? You would just never. Mm-hmm. And her mother was extremely religious and extremely frigid. And I don't know what the words are, prudish and everything like that. Right. So I don't even know if my mother ever told her. And if she didn't, her mother would have probably said, you're never going to speak a word of this to anybody.
Right. So, yeah.
It was like a really bad situation. And I have a really strong feeling, me and my family, and people who know her, that that was probably the whole thing that started this whole path that she went on. And it's just so sad because she was so brilliant, right? She's super brilliant. And but never knew how to make money or anything like that. I always wanted to be a teacher. And through all that, and because, you know, I was always teacher's pet, I always wanted to be a teacher. But I learned really early that teachers don't get paid very much. And I wanted to get paid a lot. So I was like, well, I can't do that. And then when I had my family, I became a homeschooler. So I homeschooled.
You got to teach.
So I got to fulfill my dream of teaching. And then I became a coach and was coaching people and consulting. I owned Taekwondo schools for 15 years. So there was a lot of teaching.
So do you do Taekwondo?
I'm not anymore, but mm-hmm. that was in my first marriage. And so part of that trauma of that first marriage was the Taekwondo schools. But in the childhood, what ended up happening was my mother wasn't caring for, watching over us. And so we were victims to a lot of situations that children should never be in. So, we were molested by her boyfriends. We were, and then I was kidnapped 3 different times and escaped 3 different
times. By whom?
By strangers. So the first time, and these are really stupid things, I was like 12. Mm-hmm. And I was at my grandmother's house, and my grandmother was super, super strict. She lived in Tacoma, Washington. Never let us go out or anything. And you have to remember, we were very wild. We were 4 very wild children because my mother didn't watch us. So we were totally wild when we were at my mom's house. And being at my grandmother's house was really, it was good for us, but we, of course, rebelled against it, Mm-hmm. And so we would sneak out of the windows at night and go be wild. And there was a park down the road. And there was this other park that we loved to go to called Point Defiance Park. And back in those days, it was set up, this is like before Disney and everything. So it was set up like a little fairy tale land. And we remember having good feelings going there. I wanted to go back there and experience those good feelings. And mm-hmm. so I went to the park to find a ride to this other park. And an old man in his 60s, I would say, old man, said he would give me a ride. And so he gave me a ride. He started giving me a ride, and then he wouldn't give me any more. He wouldn't take me back or anything unless I did oral sex with him. Wow. And I had no idea what it was. And so, it was really scary because I was thinking the whole time, do I do this? Do I bite it off? Do I yell and scream? Am I going to get killed? Am I going to do I just jump out of the car and then somebody else gets me? And I'm only 12. So the processing is not like an adult would think through things.
An adult would be pretty
scary
stressed with that. situation.
And so I did what he wanted me to do, even knowing what it was. And he did drive me back home. And so, but it was of course that's traumatic and it was gross and disgusting. And, all these things that were going through my head as a 12-year-old, and that was like,
did you tell anybody?
No, I never told anybody because we snuck out of the house.
You didn't want to get in trouble.
And this is the thing, almost every time when these things happen, and this happens a lot to kids, something bad happens to them, but they won't tell anybody because what they did was bad too. You put yourself in that situation, but a child is not responsible for the choices they make. So nothing that bad that happens to you. And that took me years to realize it wasn't my fault. even though I would think it was my fault because I did the bad thing first, but it's not my fault because he still didn't have a right to do that to me.
Right. You know, so, well, I know sometimes it's the fact that the child believes that nobody will believe them anyway.
That's true too.
Because I had a person that was exposing himself to me. And I was in the sixth grade, whatever the hell that makes me. It took me a long time to say anything because I thought he's an adult. To me, he was an adult. He was 18. And I thought nobody would believe me anyway. Mm-hmm. So why say anything? And so I didn't say anything until I got really scared. He did something that scared me. And then that's when I told.
Okay.
And, you know, so to me, it wasn't that I was doing anything wrong. It was that I just assumed nobody would believe me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that happens a lot with kids today too, with all the mm-hmm. situations that, especially online and stuff that happened to them and the extortion that happens with them, you know, with, and then yeah. kids kill themselves. I mean, it's really sad because they don't want to tell their parents that they actually sent a naked picture of themselves to this guy who's now blackmailing them, you know? And so it's really sad, all these different kind of forms of predatory behavior on children. So my mother took me, to Hawaii, and we were, that was one of the nice things she did for me. We did go, she loved going to, her dream was always to get a boat and put us all on the boat and take the boat to Fiji. I'm like, I'm so glad she never tried that. Because she thought she was a great sailor.
Yeah. Like, oh, who knows gosh. Where you would be right now, right?
Oh my gosh. So her brother lived in Hawaii and he was a super, super famous chef in Hawaii and all over the world, actually, but he was an alcoholic. So he lost all of that. But while he was there, we went to go see him, and he was married at the time to this really nice lady who I loved. And they had this beautiful condominium and it was overlooked the ocean and in Makaha Valley on Oahu. And it's just so gorgeous. And she had this beautiful white carpet. I'd never seen white carpet before. And it was just, everything was so clean. My house was filthy, dirty, you know, and I was just so impressed by her. And he would treat us to these nice meals and everything. And we stayed there. We were going to stay for like 2 weeks. And after a few days, my mom says, oh, we can't stay here because this is not the real Hawaii. And I'm like, why? I love it here. And she goes, no, we have to go live like the real Hawaiians live. So we left and we go to this beach where these tents are up and these fishermen are there. And there weren't as many homeless people then as there are now. But, you know, obviously there were a lot of bums and homeless people and stuff. And she's going out fishing with all these men. You know, she's just going out there in the ocean and fishing with them and stuff, coming back. And so she starts having this little thing with this guy. His name, I even remember his name. His name was Pake. And we're standing against his car, I think. And she's getting drunk and he's making out with her and he's touching my breasts at the same time. Mm. And she lied to him and told him I was her sister, not her daughter. And that was one of the things. She would always say that we were her siblings so that people would think she was younger than she really was. Mm-hmm. So that was like a very weird, and I didn't like it. And I was very angry with my mother for even not even noticing, you know, not even noticing what was going on. And why would you even like somebody who does that? And, you know, all of these kind of thoughts. And again, I'm like, I'm between 12 and 13 at this time. So I'm still really young, but growing up very fast, you know.
Definitely.
My mother would, one time she was in the hospital and I didn't go to school that day because I was making sure my brothers and sisters were getting to school. And then I can't remember what I was doing. And all of a sudden the police are at my house and they're looking for me. And so I hid and they ended up not finding me, but I could hear them and the mean things they were saying about me. And I'm thinking I've never been arrested or anything at this time. And I'm just like, none of that, you know, like, I don't even know whether this is coming from. And they called the fire department because my brother had built a tree house in the trees. And so they came and tore that down. And what had happened was the reason they were mad was because they went to the school and they picked up all my kids to put them in a receiving home. And they were taking me to juvenile hall because I was too old to go to a receiving home. So I'm like,
what's a receiving home?
It's like a pre-place before foster care.
Okay. Okay.
So they were taking them all away from my mom. Now you have to understand that. Yeah, we probably should have been in foster care, but it's still your mom and you don't want to go to foster care because you still love your mom. Not only that, we loved our wild freedom too. So
yeah,
you know, it was kind of like, it was, you know, like we weren't going to be obeying other people. And so I was hiding and then I knew I had to run away. So I ran away from home. And I was hitchhiking. So I said, I'm going to go to San Francisco. And we lived in Menlo Park. So it's like a 45-minute drive to San Francisco. We lived in the Bay Area. And so I was hitchhiking. And a guy picked me up. And I told him I was stupid. I told him I was a runaway. I was hiding from the cops and everything. And he kidnapped me. And he held me for probably about, 7 to 8 days before I finally realized I could just open the door and walk out while he was at work. I didn't even realize.
I was so scared, right?
And I was so scared, but he made me so scared of the police too, because every time he'd come out, the cops are driving down the street, you know, like, so I was more scared of the cops than of him. So, you know, he of course raped me and, you know, all this stuff and fed me once a day and there was no bathroom there. So I had to figure out how to go pee. I held number two in the whole time. It was not fun, but I was always weighing what's worse, going to juvenile hall or being, you know, or with this guy. And finally I said, it's better to go to juvenile hall. So I finally left and I turned myself in and did go to juvenile hall, which was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, probably, up to that point. But from there, they took me and put me in a group home in San Francisco for girls. And there I thrived. I did very well. I was 15 and already going to college. I was like just really, you know, smart and everything. I became a model. I was modeling for Gunny Sachs in San Francisco. My very first real job was when I was really young. I was like only at this is like same time, 12, 13. I got hired by the school district to go and teach kids who didn't know how to read. So I went to a bad area of town and taught children how to read. And I loved that job. And of course, was teaching.
That sounds impressive.
It was very fun. I really loved it. I had my own blackboard. I had like all the things that a kid as a teacher would want. And the kids just thrived, you know, and that was fun. But that was just a little, you know, like a 6-week summer kind of a job. In San Francisco, I got a job working at the county clerk's office for the water department. And I had to answer the phones and then file these papers. And the boss was so mean and he would yell at everybody. And I'm like, oh, I don't like this. And I would answer the phone and all these mad residents would be calling because this was wrong with their water, you know, and they'd be yelling and screaming at me. And I'm like, what do I have to do with it? I'm just answering the phones. And that's when that's the first thing signal that I didn't want to be bossed around.
Right. You didn't want to when you were at home either.
No,
so
no.
it translated out, right?
Another one of those things. And then the second one was when I had run away to Hawaii and I went to get a job at McDonald's. I had a fake ID and everything. And so I went to work at McDonald's this one time and I didn't even wait for my check. I just like, this is not me. During all of this time though, so in San Francisco, that was the third time I was kidnapped basically. There were a couple other situations I had gotten myself into, but in San Francisco, I was forced into sex slavery there. And, I had to give this pimp money, you know, and stuff like that, or he would tell on me and then I would go to jail. I mean, it was the whole thing. This jail thing just really was, they just knew that the jail thing would get me, I guess, you know, you know, and they never threatened me with death or killing me or no one. And back in those days, they didn't get you addicted to heroin. They didn't, you know, it wasn't any of that like it is today. Like they don't give you, there was no fentanyl, you know? So it was a quite different methods that they used. And if they knew you had done something wrong, they used that for blackmail. So it was like, well, I'll just, you know, and then they're going to believe me and not you and that kind of thing. Well, this guy, I actually put him in jail. I accused him of statutory rape. I went through the whole horrible, horrible court at 15 years old. It was disgusting. It was horrible. And the DA had told me it was going to be horrible for me, like, cause no one was going to believe me and everything. And they believed me because he had a deformity in his private area that you wouldn't know unless you had been with him. And so he got 5 years in jail, but the whole time his brothers, the whole time for the court, his brothers were in a gang and they kept threatening to kill me and everything. And I still did it. I said, I don't care. You can kill me. I don't believe you're going to kill me. And they didn't kill me because the cops would know you killed me, you know? So, yeah. You know, so I kind of knew that. So around that time I ran away and went to Hawaii, where again, I was, that was the only life I kind of knew. So
how did you get to Hawaii?
Took an airplane. I had a fake ID. Yeah. Okay. So they didn't have TSA. They didn't have, you know, it was really easy. I had was the clothes on my back and I went to go live with my uncle. And I remember my wonderful uncle, because I'm thinking he's got this beautiful apartment and everything. Well, when I get there, he had lost his job. He had gotten divorced. He was living in this crap hole apartment with another guy. I'm like, oh great. This guy looks like a molester too, you know? And I'm thinking this is disgusting. He was totally broke. He didn't pick me up from the airport in a car. So I was really shocked. And he picked me up and we had to take the bus. And I'm like, we're taking the bus, gross, you know? So all these things. And I'm like, wow, what happened to him? And it was just his alcoholism that just made him lose everything. And while I was there, so at his apartment, I was trying to figure out something to do. And then I always get attracted to bad people. And these people got me. And, you know, of course, I made money in bad ways. And, you know, so the whole, you know, by that time, you're so desensitized to having sex for money that it just doesn't even matter anymore. You know, it's kind of like, hey, it's better than being on the streets and homeless and all this stuff. And so, you know, but there, the bad part about Hawaii was if a police found out what I was doing, and I had to have sex with him once a week in order for him to keep me out of jail. You know,
wow.
So disgusting, you know, some of the police officers were in Hawaii with the working girls. And, but my whole, every time I was in those situations, I was thinking, how do you get out of this? How do I stay alive? Number one, are they going to kill me or are they not going to kill me? I'm going to ascertain that, you know, if they're not going to kill me, how much can I get away with before I run out the door or before I call the cops or before, you know, whatever the answer is going to be, right? And through that time, I discovered that I have this really strong gift to survive. You know, the survival, like I look at that whole life and think that's the woman that's 65 underneath a bridge begging you for money so she can get her next fix. You know, that's what a person that goes through that ends up like. So I kept, you know, I look back and say, all of those things that happened, they happened to set me up for being able to be an entrepreneur, being able to be successful, and being able to handle the risk and the reward. Because when you're in those situations, you know, what can happen to you is so much worse than being broke 1 month as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, yeah,
so you true. Have this different, it's a different worldview, number one. It's a different, right. I developed so much empathy through it all. That's what people always say to me. They can't not believe that I'm just like, not just stone cold, because I have a lot of empathy for people. But at the same time, I know how to put, you know how you have fight, flight, fight or flight. So freeze. And so I'm the freeze person. So I just freeze. So with the PTSD and everything, I use it to my advantage in business. So, you know, my first marriage, of course, you know, I think I told you that I 20 years and it was very physically abusive to me and my five children. My first husband was. But through all of that and that PTSD, so when someone yells at me, I don't hear anything they say. I have no clue what they say. And I always warn people. I said, if you're going to yell, you're yelling to yourself, because I'm not going to remember one thing you say. It doesn't bother me. There's a piece of glass between me and you and nothing can get through it. And that's just how I deal with that kind of, you know, aggressiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And so through all of that, you know, and of course I married an abusive person because I didn't think I was worthy because of what I've been through. Right. So I think I'm a piece of crap. And so I'm going to marry somebody who treats me like a piece of crap and make sure to remind me I'm a piece of crap.
That's right.
You know, he gets mad at me. Right. So that whole situation transpired. But through that all, I continued to have businesses. I had five children. I homeschooled them. The first thing we did, I had a daycare center. So that, because I never wanted to leave my kids. None of my kids have ever seen the inside of a daycare. And so my husband always had, you know, he worked, but I was really the bread earner most of the time, the higher bread earner. So I did the daycare centers. I did modeling. I did acting. Then I did the Taekwondo schools. And while I was married to him, we had those for like 15 years, very successful. And then after the, and during all the whole time, I was a real estate agent. So I was a real estate agent for 40 plus years. So anytime I needed money in between things or whatever, the kids could go with me to show houses and stuff like that. And then after the divorce and everything, I sold the Taekwondo schools. And then I was doing real estate for a while. And then I started doing SEO and consulting, and this whole thing grew. And then I have the VA company, a virtual assistant company that I had started because of all of the real estate. Like, it was all this, just the way, like, I don't know, I believe in God. And so I just believe it was my, it was him leading me on the path to where I needed to end up, which it was such miracles and such blessings that you don't know when you start something that that's what it's going, why you have to do it. You know,
I
never wanted to have a VA company, but I had to have the VA. So I started the VA company in 2016. I actually took over one for the VAs that were working for me and my real estate brokerage, and he was shutting it down. So I took over and reopened it. And I didn't want to, because I was in the middle of launching really good programs. I was doing all kinds of SEO courses and for Realtors Listing Academy courses and all these really great courses. I was doing Jeff Walker's product launch formula. I've been with him since he first started, and I really enjoyed all of that kind of work. And now this time, all my first five are grown, and I have a baby when I'm 44. So it was perfect for me and my baby, who I was also homeschooling. And so I was like really even fighting God about it. Like, he kept saying, you know, you need to take over this company. I'm like, no, look, here's my bucket list. It's not here. It's not one of the items.
I don't see it on the list.
You know, and I was so blessed, because this is during my second marriage. This is 4 years before my husband dies of a heart attack. I built the company up to where I could pay all my own bills. I didn't need my husband's income at all. I didn't need real estate income. And I got to move here to Utah from Florida, which I'd been wanting to do for years and years. And I never did, because my son played baseball. So I always stayed so he could play baseball in Florida. But as soon as he went to college, I told everybody, as soon as he goes, the last one's off to college, I am out of here. And I knew that as a realtor, I already knew I couldn't move as a realtor. I couldn't get a loan, because you have to be as a realtor in the next state for 2 years with tax returns showing you made money. And but because of my virtual assistant company, it's virtual. So the bank would give me a loan no matter what state I moved to. I could move anywhere I wanted. And I had a business, and I had a track record, and I had proof, and at 4 years of being in business. And that was, it was crazy. It was amazing. And my husband's like around 2019, he was getting really had like a bad case of apathy, didn't want to work anymore. He was toying whether he should retire at 65 or not, you know, just like going through a lot of stuff in his head. And so I was paying all the bills. And what a blessing that was, because I certainly didn't want to lose my house. That was my house before I got married to him. So it was like, that was like, I did not want to lose my house, you know? Right. So it was just, and in 2016, there's no way I could have seen any of that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You know, like, there's no way. It is amazing how, and I was talking to my group this morning and yesterday about how we don't realize that even something that is terrible that we're going through, there's a gift or a lesson or something that comes out of it. Mm-hmm. And it's being able to tune in to the magic in the moment of what happened, what it's leading you to. Because I like to say, you know, that it's like, you know, because God has the picture up here, and God knows all the roads that you can take. Mm-hmm. And he knows that over here, there's like a log over the road. But if you go this way and you do this, then you'll be golden. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we have to just learn to get that intuition and believe and let things happen the way they're supposed to. It's kind of like a surrender thing, you know, surrender to what's coming. And it's a beautiful how you have taken all of that and been able to see all the things, the little nuances of life that have put you to that place that was just the perfect landing for mm-hmm. what you needed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. You know, I think back to even all those times. So like when we started the Taekwondo school, we had lived in Utah. My youngest daughter was born in Utah. And then we moved to Lynnwood, Washington to open up another Taekwondo school. And I had found this perfect place for the school and everything. And, but the situation was that I had enough money. We had enough money from the sale of our home in Utah to open the school and keep us alive, you know, for like 6 months, which is what I figured it would take. But we all didn't have the money to then buy a house or even basically rent a house. And so I took all the kids and we had like this family meeting and I said, we have this perfect place. I got it really, really cheap, but we're going to do a lot of, you know, elbow grease and everything to get this fixed up. But we're going to have to, so this is the choice. We can either do this and know that we're going to be making $10,000 a month. And this is equivalent to $25,000 today. So just put that in perspective.
Okay.
$10,000 a month in gross income in that Taekwondo school, or we can use the money to go put a down payment on a house or a first license security or something like that. Right. Or we can live in the van. And we can live in the van for 2 to 3 months. Nobody will know. And we have the school. We can go eat in the school. And we'll go to YMCA to take our showers while the kids are taking their swimming classes and stuff like that. And the kids all voted for the van. And and so, you know, I have this like one video that I say, you know, how did I go from zero to $10,000 a month living in a van? You know, basically, you know, being homeless on purpose, you know, because we had a bigger goal. But because of the traumas and stuff that I had been through, like that was nothing for me.
Yeah. The van probably felt pretty comfortable.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And so it was like a totally different, like someone who had never, let's say they were coddled all their lives and stuff, they could never have done that. They would never make that decision, you know, and they would think it was child abuse and child neglect and everything. But, you know, I didn't abuse my children. I didn't neglect my husband abused them, but it was, so even with the kids, you know, they're like making that decision, it was great for them because it was a great learning lesson for them to see what you can do when you have a goal and when you have trust and faith that you're going to reach your goals and you're going to do. Not only that, it puts you in a position where you have to do what you have to do. You're not going to say, oh, I'm too tired today to go put flyers on people's cars. You know, I mean, we did that every single day. You know, where can we set up a booth? Where can we, and this is back before the internet. So everything was done. You know, you went to the print shop. I went to the print shop and they'd have to take the little letters and put them on the thing and then use the press machine, the printing machine. Wow. Like totally different days, you know, but I bought the book called Guerrilla Marketing and I just went through and I just did everything he said to do. And just, okay, that I did that. I did that. And within 6 months, we were making $10,000 a month in gross income. So, so the dream came true, you know?
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about your VA, group and, you know, cause there's probably people that are listening or watching that mm-hmm. maybe they don't really understand what a VA is and what they do. And maybe, so tell a little bit about that and then you can actually tell them how, cause you still have the company, right?
Yeah. That's what I actively work on. Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So then you can kind of tell them how to connect with you for that. Okay. So do that. And then I've got another question for you.
Okay.
If I remember in a moment. You know.
Yeah. So the company's called Get It Done For Me Now Virtual Services. We're on Facebook. You can just look up, you can even look up my name. You can just Google me, Katarina Gassett. As long as you spell my name right, you probably see everything that I do. Very active on social media. But on Facebook, we have a Facebook page called Get It Done For Me Now. And we have a group that people can join where they can learn more and, you know, maybe ask more personal questions about their situation. I am also on X a lot and Instagram, not, you know, still, but not as much, but LinkedIn, anyone can reach out to me on LinkedIn. We also have a website, it's delegatemytasks.com. And we, I have about 28 employees in the Philippines and my COO runs everything for me. And then we have a board manager. We do everything on Trello. So it's a free, all our clients have a free Trello board and they get to watch all their tasks being done. And so what kind of tasks we can do, almost anything that you can create an SOP for. But typically our most requested things are social media managing, SEO, Google Maps, blogging, article writing, article syndication, a lot of phone answering, receptionist work, virtual dialing, appointment setting, things like that. We have done stuff for big companies and little companies. We work with a lot of service-based industries, coaches, chiropractors, you know, people like that. And then realtors, of course, since I know so many of them. And then we work for a security guard company. We work for e-commerce a lot. Naturopathic doctors, people that really need to have more visibility online and hard for them to get to it because they don't have time. So also I have a virtual secretary. So I haven't answered my emails myself in 3 years. So I'm on Google chat with my receptionist or secretary, and she'll just, like today, she sent me the StreamYard, so I didn't have to go into the email to get it. She sent me the link to the podcast. So I just click on it on chat, which is a lot easier than logging into Gmail and sorting through and trying to find things. Right, and then she'll confirm my doctor's appointments for me and all that kind of stuff. But she'll also do all my trashing and getting rid of stuff and unsubscribing and all of that stuff she does for me. And so it's just, that's probably one of the most freeing things, because email's so addictive, and you feel like, and especially if you have any OCD about you at all or organization about you, you don't want to leave it until you organize it all and you want to get rid of stuff. And that's just a waste of time, total waste of time.
Yeah.
No. And then you tend to look at stuff you don't need to look at. I don't mean bad things, but I mean, like, this is a waste of time to read this newsletter. Right. You know, it's not, you're not going to ever do anything in this topic. So just don't read it, you know?
Yeah. So, well, can I tell you one of my worst habits when it comes to email? I will look at the subject to see if it's something I want to dive into, right? Mm-hmm. And if not, I don't delete it because I'm busy doing it. That just takes more time. So I don't want to tell you how many thousands of emails I have right now. Mm-hmm. And luckily Yahoo will let you just delete everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But not Gmail. No, yeah. You have to go in there and you have to completely delete it. Yeah. And then I can pick up my phone and it's not gone from there. It's still here. Somebody says, how many emails you got? I'll just tell you right here. Do you want me to tell you how much it says?
Yeah, tell me how many you have. That's not
now, don't pass out, okay?
Okay.
210,000.
Oh my gosh. But you also run out of space at that rate.
Well, I got a large phone, luckily. Okay. Yeah. Okay, but it's like, if I had realized that you couldn't just say, delete all these things from this date to this date, you know? But I will look at things. And then some of them, if I look at it and I don't really need it, then I'll delete it. But all the others that I just bypass.
Yeah, I know. That's what Vanessa does for me, because I don't have time to sit there and delete them even. So what I used to do, my big answer to this back in 2008, 2009, like around there, is I would just start a new email account because I didn't want to go before I had a secretary. I'm just like, I'm not dealing with this. Just like the whole thing. Anybody who really needs to get a hold of me will find me, but I can't do that anymore because of the businesses, you know?
Right.
So yeah. I just can't do that. And so we have a rule that it can't be more than 500 on the important box, and social has to be totally empty every day. Updates can be 200-ish, and then the
promotion. So you delete your emails off of socials too? Your messages?
So on Gmail,
you can tell I don't do that.
Tabs, right? I have tabs. So I have important, I have social, I have updates and promotional, and the social tab is all your notifications. And I never look at those.
Okay. I got you. For a minute, I was about to think, oh my God, I've got another place that I'm supposed to be doing something. I'm not doing
probably all in the same. Yeah. I just wanted them divided up because it's a lot easier to just delete all the social stuff, because I get my notifications for Messenger on my phone. So I don't need it in Gmail too. Right. And same with a lot of them. Some places I don't even set up notifications, and some places I do because my VAs can take my notifications, you know? So for all the business stuff they handle, I don't get notified of anything. They take care of all of that. Only my personal stuff on my personal Facebook page I do because of my kids, you know, and stuff, because my personal Facebook page is actually my business page, because now you can have it set up.
Yeah. Mine is, I still have a business page, but I do everything on my personal
page. And that's how it should should be. That's how you should, because nobody goes to business pages.
Yeah. So, I just use it in case I want to run an ad.
You need it for running ads. Exactly. Yeah. We get a lot of activity on some of our pages though. So I'm pretty impressed, but yeah, but I only do stuff on my personal one, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So what kind of coaching do you do?
So I coach businesses more like a consulting, going through their strategies, learning what they need to get rid of, what they need to implement. I do help people with how to onboard to VAs. Like if they have a lot, like if it's you have a lot on your plate and you can't now take it all off, and you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So the thing I always tell people is once you do take stuff off the list, new stuff appears, because it's the way it goes. So you have to always be cognizant of the stuff you shouldn't be doing. So my big mantra is, why are you doing $25 an hour, $15 an hour tasks when you make $300 an hour? It is a total waste of your energy, your time, but it's also, you're not creating the income that you need to create, because you're wasting that time doing tasks someone else can do for you, and you can't scale and grow. So I help companies scale and grow. And sometimes it might be that we need to do lead generation for them. Sometimes it's just that they've messed everything up so bad, we got to fix it all, you know, things like that. And I also help with coaching with their websites. Like a lot of people want to do their own websites. And they just want to pick my brain about, you know, how it needs to look, things like that. Because I'm very expensive at website design, since I don't want to do it all day long every day. So I'm very, very picky. I have a webmaster on our team, and she does it, but she doesn't have the, you know, design that I have, you know, like she doesn't have the design brain that I have. And so, but if a client already knows what they want, then it's a lot less expensive to just hire the VAs to do their website for them, things like that. So I do a lot of that.
Okay. Well, that sounds amazing. Gosh, what business doesn't need that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you can tell with how many emails I've got that, you know, I probably should get an assistant too.
Yeah.
We might have to talk about that, but we're getting close to time.
Okay.
So is there anything that you want to share that maybe I haven't asked a question that you wanted, you in your mind as you were talking? I want to make sure I say that. Okay. Is there something that you want to share, or some last words for everybody? Because you have an amazing story. I mean, I really feel like, you know, we could do another one and dive into some of the other stuff to help a lot of people that maybe have had that happen, or that might be getting faced with some of that stuff now. Who knows? I mean, it's crazy sometimes. But is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah. So a couple of things. First thing is, if you are being abused in a relationship, that in today's world, there's a lot of support for you. So when I was going through the domestic violence, it was in the 70s and 80s. And that time frame, there wasn't even women's shelters, and no cop would believe you. You'd have to say that your husband hit you or your wife hit you in front of the police officers, in front of the spouse. So most of the time that's not going to happen, because they're threatening to kill you if you do that. So you're not going to do it. So, but today it's like, you have to, I'll never condone somebody hitting somebody, but if you have, like, if you're afraid for your children, if you're afraid that you're going to leave and you're leaving your children with him, then you have other decisions to make. So sometimes, and never judge somebody. That's my biggest thing. Women should never judge other women who stay in abusive relationships, because you're not walking in their shoes. You do not know what they've been through. You don't know why they're in that place they're at and why they can't get out. And those are so important to understand those. And then the other thing is, if you have past traumas, if you have things that have happened to you, don't be ashamed of them. I mean, my first husband never allowed me to talk about this. My second husband never allowed me to talk about it. And it was the most freeing thing to be able to come out and help other people and say, yeah, this happened to me. It doesn't diminish who I am. It actually made me who I am. And it doesn't matter, because, you know, I believe in Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ died for my sins. And so I am cleansed. I have no sin. And it doesn't matter if someone forced me or you did it on your own will. You know, if you are in the sex trade at all, if you're having, if you're doing, you know, the new, whatever that is, Facebook, I mean, fan, whatever, I can't remember the name of it, but the one where the girls, you know, send naked pictures to guys and stuff. If you're trying to get out of that, it's okay. You know, get out of it, but don't be ashamed of what you went through. And don't make decisions on who you're going to marry and everything based on those past experiences.
Yeah, great advice. Great advice. And so that, you know, really, that's such a heart-wrenching message too, because, you know, there's a lot of people that deal with that and just don't see a way out. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's beautiful about you getting on here and talking and sharing all of this, and then what you just said, is that anybody that's going through it can say, oh my gosh, she did it. Maybe mm-hmm. I can too.
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because what you dealt with and went through as a young child is like, it's incomprehensible, right?
It is.
And so to see you sitting here today, I mean, you would never know. And not that you might not cry at night or something, I don't know. But it's like, it's such a gift that you're sharing of hope for people, that it would have been amazing if you'd had that hope back then.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. And yeah. you don't know, but it is how it's made me strong. It's made me who I am. It's made me be able to get through everything else that happens to me in life. It helps me, like, things don't seem traumatic things happen, but they're not traumatic because of the past traumas.
It's what you compare it to, right?
When you compare it to the other, it's like there's nothing. And that's what you have to remember when you're going through trauma and everything. And even if you're in it, or if you lived it, or you're going through it now, you can turn those into positive. You can turn it into something positive in your life. You can either help other people with it. You can incorporate it into your business, your personality. You can help other people. Like, the empathy thing is huge. People with PTSD have amazing gifts. And so instead of us being victims that we have PTSD, we got to own it. And we say, PTSD is good for us. This is what we do with our PTSD. It's actually a gift. So
right.
Think about that. You're not a victim. You can't be. If you stay in victim mentality, you're never going to amount. You're going to always lose. Because I say, I'm not a victim. I was a victim. Then I became a survivor. But that's not even good enough. I'm a conqueror. So I conquered it all. And that's when you're going to be successful in life, in your relationships, and in your businesses.
Right. Beautiful. That's why I say that my podcast is about our mosaic life. And the stories that I have of people, guests that come on and tell such amazing stories, that it's like, you know that there's a God because mm-hmm. of how things transpired. But so thank you so much for being here and being vulnerable and sharing your story. I'm so appreciative of you.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm glad I could share. So hopefully
yes.
help somebody with this story.
Yes, definitely. So I will end with my phrase that I say every single time. The best way to predict the future is create it. What are you creating? And with that, I will see you next time. Mwah.